Across the world, nationalism is on the rise. Under President Erdogan, Turkey has seen a rise in state power, militarism, and authoritarian control. This week on Trending Globally, we're bringing you an interview with three sociologists, all of whom study nationalism and state formation. They argue that looking back to the early 20th century at the origins of nationalism in Turkey can help us understand global politics today. Müge, Svenja, Yasmin, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Fatma Müge Göcek is a professor of sociology and women's studies at the University of Michigan. Her book, Denial of Violence, is about the 1915 Armenian genocide. In it, she uses the term ontological nationalism to explain the founding of the Turkish Republic. Müge, I wanted to start with this notion of ontological nationalism. How is that different from plain old nationalism? I know you are studying it in the context of Turks and Kurds, but I'm sure it has broader applications. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. Nationalism is interesting because, of course, for two reasons. One is that it is an imagined community. So it's the imagined part of it which is important, and a community that doesn't exist naturally, in quotations, but rather one that is put together around an idea or an ideology. And it's how that imagination works to construct the community that becomes very important. The second part of it has to do with the exclusions and inclusions that you have to undertake in constructing that community. And that is why I think nationalism is a very good way analytically to study inclusions and exclusions of social groups in a society. And we do know that nationalism has a violent side, because those who are excluded usually face a lot of different things, usually not very pleasant, and they do so from the vantage point of the state, because the state excludes them, and then by doing that legitimates to a certain degree the violence. I study violence because my social justice sort of objective is to make sure everyone is able to participate in a society or an imagined community, not in accordance with the state or others want them to do, but in accordance with their own wishes and desires and visions. I have written a book called Denial of Violence about violence against the Armenians, and how Armenian genocide basically came to be. I mean, and how violence had sustained itself over for a very long time. But that, of course, happened during the Ottoman times, and as a consequence, it wasn't a part of the Republican narrative, but it was actually a foundational violence that enabled the Republican era to succeed. So I said, there must be an exclusion here that is so strong that they are not even defined as the other. I mean, they're literally defined out of the boundary of the imagined community. And that's why I came about ontological, because it basically doesn't take even their being into account. And when I was thinking about that, I always am afraid of Orientalism, and I don't want people to say, well, these are the crazy Turks again, and that's why they're doing what they're doing, because there are those who say that, you know, Turks are by, you know, inclination difficult people and violent people. So I thought, well, what would be the analogy in the American context? And then I said, well, if you think about the United States and how it came to be, I mean, our founding narrative is one that is very much, centered around white settlers coming here, our founding fathers, and all of that. This wasn't tabula rasa. There were lots of Native Americans who were here. But we, I think, in a very similar way, ontologically erased them too.
Svenja, you study Western Europe. Do you see this applicable in contemporary Western Europe?
Svenja Kopiciak is a researcher studying right-wing populism, Islam and politics, and migration.
I think I see more a rise of ethnic nationalism or ethno-nationalism in the context, because let's say in the case of Europe now, Muslims are often constructed as the other. But there is a recognition that they are part of the community. I don't want to say part of the nation, because they're excluded from the nation, but they are still seen as the others. So the nation is constructed as opposed to Muslims, as the enlightened West. Mm-hmm.
What is very surprising to me, though, is that all Europeans think that history does not matter as to why these people arrived when they did and where they did. Because if you think about it, I mean, we have very strong imperialism through the 19th and 20th centuries. So these are all people from former colonies. I mean, they didn't just happen to come to Europe, because they came to Europe because it was the metropole and they were in the periphery. But of course, that history is very similarly ontologically dismissed. Mm-hmm. So that the French say, why are the Algerians coming? Well, I can tell you why if you know the history.
Well, actually, I was thinking about this notion of constructing a narrative. You know, you tell your own story and you exert control through the story and what you teach your children and, what children learn in school. So don't all nations do this?
Yeah, I mean, you can talk, Yasemin, if you want to, about the Turkish educational system since you went through it, right?
Yeah, I was thinking about this notion of denial that the Denial of Violence book talks about and theorizes upon. And it talks a lot about the foundational violence of the founding of the Turkish society, the imagination of the Turkish society and the state, and the reproduction of that denial through generations by, for example, Turkish educational system that erases all traces of either Kurdish or Armenian or Greek involvement within the communities.
This is Yasmin Babvek, a researcher studying nationalism and state formation.
So the nation becomes just a possession of the Turkish people, who are defined as Turkish. Göcek talks about the emotional aspect of this and what does it do to the moral fabric of a society and what does it do to democracy. Can you actually achieve true democracy by denying such violence in the foundation of the republic?
And that's true. It's fascinating when I talk to non-Turks in Turkey. I mean, for example, Armenians, who've been there for a very long time, actually in Asia Minor before the Turks arrived, they say when they're on the streets and people say, oh, yeah, what's their name? Or in the taxi, and they tell their name and they say, oh, and when did you arrive in Turkey? Thinking they're like recent arrivals, and they feel like, hey, we've been here before you people. I mean, so in a way, likewise, I mean, I had no idea there were Armenians, because in our educational system, they don't at all figure out, I mean, or what we did to them or anything. Mm-hmm. So it is, of course, terrible that they are all written out of history.
Mm-hmm. And also, there is also this dimension of diffusion, like the diffusion of displacement from, for example, Turkish displacement from Balkans, Armenian displacement, massacres, genocide from the Asia Minor, and then displacement of Azerians, for example, in other parts of the world. So these displacements are also coming from denials of displacement and reproducing the same mechanisms over and over again.
Yasmin, can I ask you, when do you remember the moment when you noticed or understood the discrepancy between what you had been taught and what the reality, the truth was?
I think in the college education, basically, like there were, of course, traces of ambiguity, or like things don't fit together when you listen to national historiographies. There are lots of questions that arise from, like, there is lots of silence on things that are glaring sciences. So when you actually think about it, you notice that something is very amiss in this whole narrative about the construction of the Turkish Republic.
I'm very interested, Svenja, about how you came about critical thinking. Did you get your education in Germany?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that would be interesting too, because obviously there at least you have acknowledged violence and the Holocaust, but people now argue that that coverage also is problematic.
Yeah, I think I actually did come through to critical thinking and the questions related to discrimination, exclusion, etc., because of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And I grew up with talking about the Holocaust, like, throughout all my education, school education, basically. Oh, so
well, arguably Germans do it best, right?
Yeah, we do it best, but by now a lot of people argue that it's kind of overdone, so people get tired of it, right? And my generation still had grandparents who lived through that time, so it was very close to us, and we like people we loved were intricate in what happened in the history, and so for me it was. I felt it was necessary to digest it and to talk about it and be aware of it and even feel a certain kind of guilt. But people who are even 10 years younger than me who don't know their grandparents anymore or their grandparents were not in the war, it's very different for them. So they get very tired of going over and over it again.
Does it create a backlash? Might it?
Yeah. I think people are tired of feeling kind of guilty for something that they didn't commit. And when I talk to friends in other countries in Europe, they're like, why are you feeling bad about the Holocaust? It was not you who committed it.
Okay, your last book, Denial of Violence, has, I guess, informed how you are approaching your work with the Kurds. And I was very interested to hear you talk last night about learning Kurmanji, but even for the last book, reading over 300 memoirs to understand, I guess, how Turks go about denying so effectively the genocide, and that as an act of democracy or equality or a gesture of social justice or something. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, in a moment of madness is when I decided, you know, for me, the denial of the genocide or, you know, violence against the Armenians by the Turkish state was understandable to a certain degree because states have no hearts and they always put their real interests before everything else. But what I was unnerved about was Turkish society. I mean, you know, so how could society go along with this violence? And I said, well, because of that, I'm not going to use state documents alone, but everybody was fighting over those documents as if they contain the truth. Well, they contain some part of it, but they were state documents, obviously. And how do I get then to what people thought? And I said, well, very great, I'll do the memoirs. I had no idea how many memoirs there were, so I had to read like 700 or something. I was trying to basically capture the collective opinion that formed through the memoirs. Then I made a list of all the ones that mentioned collective violence, Armenians, and sort of violence. And that is how I ended up with the 350. And in there were some Kurdish memoirs. And also, because it was from the Ottoman Empire to the Turkish Republic, I also saw that after the Armenians were decimated and destroyed, Kurds emerged as the new other in the Republic and started having the same kind of violence. So once I was done with the Armenian book, I said, well, now it's time to look at the Kurds. But of course, they're still about 20% of the population. So I couldn't, as an ethnic Turk, study the Kurds without learning their language, at least out of respect, if not anything else.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. I'm interested because Svenja, you're German, mm-hmm. and you study Western Europe
here.
And you're Turkish, and you study Turkey here. And you're Turkish, and you're studying here.
And who knows where you go?
So I'm wondering, does the distance affect your scholarship? And if so, in what way?
Well, you are the one whose future is at least most in doubt. So where do you position yourself?
Well, it's very hard for me to actually position myself somewhere at this point because I am in U.S. academia and Turkish academia is in a very precarious situation at the moment, and it's very hard to gauge what the future of Turkish academia is going to be. Lots of academics have left Turkey for Europe or U.S. So it's a very in-between situation, let's say.
No, it must be incredibly precarious.
Oh, yes. I mean,
yeah, so it also affects the scholarship if you're going back to Turkey, traveling to Turkey all the time. It's kind of what you do politically in your work.
You have to self-censor.
Yes.
I mean, which is terrible. And mm-hmm. I, of course, don't have to do that. But when I went back to do my, you know, dissertation work and later other work, they said to me in Turkey, why did you have to go all the way to America to study these things? You know, you could have done them here, but you couldn't because you don't have freedom of expression and thought.
Can you talk about why you can't go back?
Oh, yes, because I signed this peace petition in January 2016 about stopping the violence against the Kurds and adopting a diplomatic way of negotiating with them rather than killing them. 2,200 people did, mostly academics. And the day after, our esteemed president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, said that we were all guerrillas, Kurdish guerrillas, and there was no difference between the machine gun of a guerrilla and the pen of an academic. And that was that, right? You remember that?
Such rhetoric. Wow.
It is such rhetoric. Yeah, and since then, I mean, I figured I already was suspect because of the work I did on the Armenian, you know, violence against the Armenians. So
I didn't realize it was so recent that you couldn't go back.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Yeah. I was last there in November 2015.
Mm-hmm. And Svenja, how does the distance from Western Europe affect your scholarship?
I also feel like I'm more in between the two countries. So while I'm an academic here, we are usually home in our, well, Yasemin and I at least, mm-hmm. are usually home for 4 months a year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while I'm here doing the work, I'm still there and doing the research. So for me, I'm really in between. Mm-hmm. So,
so in a way, it might be giving you perspective. It might be giving you just enough distance.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think not disconnect.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, that whole concept of in-betweenness is a very interesting concept because nationalism, especially, and modernity, sort of makes sure that you belong somewhere, you know. And then for a long time for me, it was very difficult because I didn't belong in Turkey anymore, obviously. And I don't belong here fully either because I'm not, you know, I'm an American immigrant. I'm a newcomer, right? So how do you then make sense of this in-betweenness? And that's, I think, why critical sociology is so helpful in a way. By taking a critical approach, you say, well, that in-betweenness is not a liability. It could be an asset because of the way it positions you in between these two societies, and you can be almost an interlocutor
exactly.
in between the two of them, right? I mean, hopefully, maybe you'll get a job in Europe. Is that?
Yeah, that would be very nice.
I'm just going to look over these questions. I want to make sure we don't miss anything. Oh, I know one thing we haven't talked about is where gender and intersectionality fits into all of this. How can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. So, I mean, when you look at ontological nationalism or this hegemonic narratives that dictate our lives, obviously, it's very destructive, and that it doesn't allow any space for anyone other than the majority to exist. So how do we create these spaces? I think we create them first by demonstrating the public invisibility of the people who are excluded in this very dramatic way through ontological nationalism. And Kimberly Crenshaw and, Patricia L. Collins talk about matrix of domination and then later intersectionality as a way to highlight black women specifically, because the black women are not a part of the civil rights movement dominated by black men or women's movement dominated by white women. So if you look at it intersectionally through their vantage point, then you become aware that there is a space. These people exist, but they don't have a public space within which to carry out their conversation. So that is why I brought gender in again to studying nationalism in Turkey and Kurdistan, to create this space and make people aware of it. I said, well, this is how they're doing it. Let's see what happens in the case of Turkey. And suddenly, you find all these amazing practices the Kurdish women are doing at the moment in the name of gender equity, and the Turkish women cannot engage in it at all because they're into this whole ontological nationalism thing. which if they lifted that off of their mind, then they could get into conversation, and all women in Turkey, regardless of their race or ethnicity, would benefit from it.
Right, because gender is the broadest. Yes. I mean, they're all women.
Of course, yes.
But they're divided by these
Islamists, secularists on the Turkish side, and then the Kurdish women, of course, are marginalized there, and there are the ones who are guerrillas, and they're the activists.
Are you optimistic that...
I am. The only thing that makes me optimistic is people like Svenja and Yasemin, because at least there's a future, I mean, a critical future. I mean, our generation, I always tell my students, we mess things up, you know, good luck to you. but hopefully they are the ones who will find solutions, mm-hmm. because I'm, at the moment, I cannot see a way out of Turkey. I don't know if I'll ever be able to go back, but we'll see. At least you're going back. That's important, yes. Right?
How do you, both of you, and of course Muge as well, how do you see yourself within and beyond the academy? I mean, do you see activism as part of your role as academics or not? Are you the same person when you're in your scholarship as you are when you're home, just being a person? Yasmin.
Okay. Well, I think the political activism of a person shouldn't be separated from the academic part of a person. So the academic as a person has responsibilities to the publics that she is writing for or writing against, whichever mm-hmm. Alignments mm-hmm. that she's seeking. But also, it's very important to reflect on the academic's own position and power position of the academic herself vis-a-vis other groups that she's engaging with. For example, in terms of knowledge production, the academic should be very aware of where she's standing in terms of having institutional support, and that brings a certain responsibility to not impose an academic type of knowledge into or categorize people into academic categories rather than listening to what's going on and partnering with people, for example, in search for a better democracy, for example.
And that depends. I mean, we're both from Turkey, Yasemin and I, but, you know, when I give talks, usually I do have Turkish students come to me and say, we are so glad you're expressing this as a senior professor. And I say to them, yes, as a junior person, you do not have yet the weight to be able to, you know, pull that off, because they're in much vulnerable positions. I mean, we should be the ones doing the fighting. Yeah. If you're a bystander, Hannah Arendt would say, you help reproduce the system.
I want to thank you all for coming in today. This was fascinating, and I wish you continued success in your scholarship.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we are building a community, and that's the most important thing, and I think Brown University in general and Michael Kennedy in particular has a vision that definitely does serve into creating this imagined critical community that doesn't take things as they appear for granted, but rather questions them.
Hear, hear. Thank you for that.
This has been Trending Globally, Politics and Policy. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or download us on your favorite podcasting app. If you like us, rate us, and help others who might enjoy the show find us. For more information, go to watson.brown.edu.